This show furnished by Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn.
It's time for Gervy's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervy. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Carrie Kasem. Carrie brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervy and Carrie Kasem.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles, and everyone listening around the world on KBC.com. I am Alan Gervy, and I am the managing partner of the law firm. That means I'm a lawyer of Rowan, Gervy, and Wynn. And today, as usual, on this fine Saturday afternoon, I am here to be the managing partner of your life as the music slowly fades out. I am here today, as usual, with Carrie Kasem, my very capable co-host. Hi, Carrie.
Oh, hi, Alan.
How's it going?
It's pretty good, actually.
You know, I'm so thrilled. I am so happy. I've been here for about a minute now, and no one from KBC Security has come to drag me out of my seat.
Oh, wait, and I see bounce, them looking through the windows.
Bounce me against the walls, bloody my face and my ear. They haven't done it. I haven't been removed.
No. You know, then their stock would tank, too, probably.
The Cumulus stock?
Yeah, would just go
it would
right.
Never tank.
No, yeah, if they dragged you out.
I should be dragged out, I think. I would probably call a lawyer.
I was going to say, you are a lawyer, and I don't think they'd probably drag me out before they dragged you.
No, I don't think so. But, you know, I'll tell you, it's amazing that we had an ability to have that videotaped.
Because
yes. Now that we all have seen it, we start thinking, you know, maybe that wasn't the best strategy.
No, and you know, I have to say, I've been laughing all week long, and it's kind of mean because not everybody United is this way, and I feel terrible for the good people and the pilots, but wow, are there some funny things out there. Like, I was on Southwest a couple days ago, and somebody had put up, actually my friend Marisol Nichols put up a Southwest new slogan, "We beat our competitors, not you." And it had just come out, so I was passing it around the plane, and we were just dying. All of us were laughing. And then the one I just showed you about how United pilots come to work, yeah. And they showed you the scene from
Airplane. Right.
Yeah,
right.
Where the captain's kind of beating up everybody.
Yeah. Other, yeah. Well, it was probably ill-advised. As an attorney, I think that United will pay. Obviously, you don't have to be brilliant person to understand that was probably inappropriate. You probably should leave someone in their seat when they're refusing
yes.
to leave and deal with it later. There's always ways to deal with these things. And even if you had four of your employees who wanted to get on that flight, maybe you could have figured out an alternative strategy than yanking someone out of their seat.
My seatmate, who I met named Bobby, we were sitting there and he's like, you know, I came up with this great idea. Why don't they just have a few seats that are marked, where you may have to be bumped a flight. It's their way, they're discounted, but you know that these couple seats or these four seats or whatever, you may get a bump and you maybe get two bumps, but you
know,
get really
you
cheap
don't need,
seats.
You don't need to do that. There's ways to handle this, and obviously,
but how? Nobody would get off the plane. So just what I would have said is just ground the plane, so nobody can go. So eventually, people would leave.
Listen,
right?
If people have seats and there are no volunteers to get off the plane, then so be it. That's the problem. Then they deal with it. It's called compensation, and they give significant compensation.
Oh, they did, and nobody would get off. They went up to $800, and nobody would get off the plane. Now, my thought was, get these other people on another flight, maybe on another airline. Get them to I guess it was they needed to go to a different airport to get on another flight.
You know what? I don't really care.
Well, we have to come up with some solution, Alan, here.
It's their business. I mean, run it properly. Just don't do this. Don't waste our time with dragging people off planes. And you know, even if this doctor, he's a fine doctor, isn't he?
I don't know. And even if he was not, I think that when you lose $1 billion and you have such a horrible publicity mess on your shoulders, you're going to do anything to discredit somebody. Anything.
And I deal with that every day. Of course, I represent injured workers, and the employers, big time employers, will go out of their way to dig up stuff. And it is embarrassing when I'm sitting in a deposition and I find out my client, you know, had an affair with a 26-year-old man and then had the man work for them, like apparently Dr. Dow, the guy who was pulled off the plane, did, you know, all kinds of things in his past. I don't think that he's the stellar doctor, but of course it doesn't matter because it doesn't give anyone license to beat the crap out of someone and pull them off the plane. But, you know, it happens with me all the time, and I hope like heck that when I'm in a deposition that there isn't some investigations that have gone on and shown my client to be a real jerk. Which sometimes it occurs. Other times you can't get anything on them, and they try. It's called a fishing expedition.
Sure.
And they fish to try and find something that they can use against them rather than dealing with the facts, which in this case is some guy getting pulled off the plane with a video. And isn't it reminiscent of a video that started it all in 1992? Or 1991, actually. I was working at NBC, and the first job that I had to do, I had to go and see George Holliday, who had a press conference about the video. Do you know what video I'm talking about?
Yes, I do. Rodney King.
Rodney King. Exactly. That's how it started way back when George Holliday was sitting in his apartment or standing. I'm not sure, I wasn't there, but he was on his balcony. He videotaped Rodney King getting beaten up by a number of cops. Four were up for trial, of course, and there were a number that were watching, and then that video went viral, even though there wasn't even viral back then.
Very true.
And look at what happened. A year later, after the verdicts in Simi Valley, the riot started, and we are celebrating 25 years, and we're not celebrating at all, but we're commemorating 25 years since the riots this month.
That's true. And, you know, I have to say that I remember that. I remember the riots. I remember Reginald Denny getting dragged out of his truck like it was yesterday.
Well,
I can remember those scenes.
You're going to have an opportunity to see it all over again, because there's no less than 7 films, documentaries that are coming out in the next couple of weeks, all focusing on what occurred in L.A. in 1992 and, of course, before that in 1991. In fact, later in the show, we have award-winning producer Jonathan Chin on our show. He produced the show with his cousin Simon Chin. The show is called L.A. 92, and it is a video montage, basically, of all the events back then. And there's little scene video that they will show in this film, L.A. 92. It's premiering at the Tribeca Film Festival. Then it'll be on the National Geographic station at the end of the month. It's orchestrated. All of the video is orchestrated without script. Isn't that interesting?
Do you mean they put the whole thing together and there's no, like, narrator?
Something like that.
Okay.
So the producer is Lightbox, and you don't want to miss L.A. 92, the documentary, and we will be talking to Jonathan Chin at the bottom of the hour. Before we get to Jonathan, we are doing our show on the riots and the Rodney King beating, and we're privileged to have with us after the break Larry Spagnola, who wrote with Rodney King the book The Riot Within, My Journey from Rebellion to Redemption. That was published about 5 years ago, actually, in about 9 days. On April 24th, 2012, the book came out with Rodney King, of course, who was beaten senseless on that fateful day. And we have Larry Spagnola on, who is a writer. He also wrote a book called My Appetite for Destruction, Sex and Drugs and Guns and Roses. And he helped with Sweet Child of Mine, which is story of Stephen Adler by his mother, Deanna Adler. We can talk to him about that as well. But we want to talk about Rodney King. We want to talk about the real legacy of the racial tension in this city and around the country. I don't know if things have changed that much over the last 25 years, but it is 25 years since the Rodney King beatings. We're going to have Larry on the show when we get back. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
I don't know if you can, but can you get an order for ONS? That's ONS Junior Market.
Say there, what's the frequency?
1090.
And the letters?
KABC.
I'm Alan. Nice to meet you.
Have you or someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn Lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn Lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RGW Lawyers won't give up when the insurance company failed you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposure, cancers, and death. RGW Lawyers are compassionate and aggressive with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner if you're suffering from a work-related injury. Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn Lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now. 855-4-RGW-LAW. 855-4-RGW-LAW or go to rgwlawfirm.com.
Spring fever is here. It's that time when everyone and everything goes crazy. And that's what happened to my sewer line. Yeah, that's right. 3 hours before a dinner party, it clogged and water backed up into the sinks. Fortunately, I did know who to call. SoCal Plumbers 911. SoCal Plumbers 911 is the referral service for the very best plumbers in LA. Here's how to get in touch with them. Go to SoCalPlumbers911.com or call 1-877-PLUMBER. They're offering $50 off your entire bill just to try them out. For any plumbing problem, remember 1-877-PLUMBER.
The Pasadena Playhouse presents The Originalist, a powerful portrayal of passionate people risking heart and soul to defend their interpretation of the truth and the Constitution. Performances begin April 11th through May 7th. For tickets, visit PasadenaPlayhouse.org.
Smart and Final is your Easter savings headquarters with prices up to 25% lower than supermarkets. Now through April 18th, Farmer John Fresh, never frozen, bone-in spiral sliced hams are $1.57 a pound with a $25 additional purchase. See store for details. Happy Easter from Smart and Final.
Okay, here we go. Drive home promo, take one.
Hey, it's Jillian Barbary, and how do you want me to say in the beginning?
On the next drive home.
Okay.
Here we go. Take two.
Coming up on the drive... Blah, blah, blah.
Take three.
Coming up on the drive home with John. I can never do these. Oh, I'm not going to be able to do it.
You're telling me.
F*** you.
Just listen in between three and six on talk...
Can I just add that now?
Sure.
Okay.
Take... whatever.
Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yeah, great job, Jill.
Some legal, moral, or just common sense advice from a friend? Call Alan Gervie and Carrie Kasem now at 800-222-KABC. That's 800-222-5222.
Yes, we are back. I'm Alan Gervie. 800-522-2222. There's a lot of twos in there.
522-2222.
I'm wearing my tutu here today. And we're listening to Sweet Child of Mine. You're a rock fan. Didn't you do that show with that rocker, Nikki Sixx?
I did.
My buddy DJ Ashba's partner?
Yeah, they are now. But Guns N' Roses, hands down, was and probably still is my favorite rock band of all time. Appetite for Destruction, every single song on that album was fantastic.
Wow. So that's so cool that you are now sitting next to you, the man who wrote the book. On Steven Adler, My Appetite for Destruction, Sex and Drugs and Guns and Roses. But we're going to talk about that a little bit later. First of all, I want to introduce Larry Spagnola, who wrote the book with Rodney King. We're commemorating the 25th year, the anniversary of the LA riots. It's this month, believe it or not, folks. You probably all remember where you were 25 years ago when the city was burning. The book is called The Riot Within, My Journey from Rebellion to Redemption. Harvard-educated, award-winning writer Larry Spagnola, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's great to have you. You have to tell us how you got involved with Rodney King. He has such a legacy now, and you wrote the book with him. not an easy thing to do.
Rodney was in that sophomore year of Dr. Drew's Celebrity Rehab.
And of course, Dr. Drew from KBC.
That's right. And his roommate happened to be Steven Adler. I guess there's an episode where Dr. Drew asks everyone in the room what they're doing with their lives presently. And Steven said, I get this great book and it should be coming out soon. And I finally get a lot of things off my chest about being raped as a child and things that no one knows. There are a couple of big revelations. And they get back to their rooms, and Rodney wanted to know all about this book process because he had tried to get a couple of books projects started, and each one failed. And he thought Stephen was the kind of guy he could relate to, and if someone knew Stephen and was writing a book, maybe it would all work. So I met Rodney through Stephen Adler.
It's crazy. How did he not have a book written about him with his involvement before? This was, what, 2010 when you met him?
Yeah, no, it's fascinating you say that. That was one of his major lamentations, was the fact that every cop, every lawyer, every bystander had already, you know, made money off his back.
Right.
They'd been on Letterman. They'd written their books. They'd been on other talk shows. And he really wanted his shot. And he also felt, well, you know what? Maybe the last word gets the best word. And that was his way of settling into this.
But did people think that it just wouldn't sell? People wouldn't read his story? Did they? What was, I mean, if I was a writer, that's somebody I would go, hey, I could, first of all, make money off of, and what a great story to tell.
What, you're calling Larry an opportunist?
Not an opportunist, a businessman. Because you don't want to write a book nobody's going to buy.
But, you know, Rodney King, he was just this guy in the wrong place at the wrong time who knew that there was anything interesting that anyone would want to read about him other than that he was a punching bag.
And yet his words will probably outlive presidents. I mean, long after people have forgotten Bush saying, read my lips, or Reagan saying, we bomb Russia in 5 minutes, they're going to remember Rodney saying, can't we all get along?
That's
I
right.
really feel that strong. Even Clinton, I'll swing over to Democrats, saying, I did not have sex with that woman.
Right, you know, do that well.
You have to understand that his words, and he asked me that once, he said, do you think people will remember me? I said, they may forget you, but they're not going to forget what you said. And that was ad-libbed by Rod.
What was weird was just short time before his unfortunate passing, and we're talking about Rodney King here, he said that his legacy would be exactly that, and he actually said, when I'm gone, people will remember me for saying that, and I hope they do because I really believe it. And then about 6 months later, he was actually gone.
Yeah, I mean, as I got to know him, he really struck me as a man-child. There was a side of him that was so innocent and so fun to be with, that loved the outdoors, that loved camping and fishing and being with his nieces and nephews and his daughters. And then there was this side of him that was really dark. And I think if you look at his upbringing, you look at the fact that he lived in this area of Altadena where there were Crips and Bloods, and they had to not join either one if they were going to live. That was the one thing his father and mother got through to the kids. Do not join either of those groups. You were born in the hood, so they will respect you, and they won't ever kill you. But if you join one or the other, it's a death sentence.
Why was he so messed up? Because he had these values after the fact, after he was beaten. He would talk about, like you just said, can't we all just get along? And people were upset with him about that. They were saying, why can't you defend yourself? You were robbed, basically. The cops were acquitted. They should not have been, by the Simi Valley, mostly white jury. And you're not angry. You're saying we should get along.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably that's what makes it an immortal passage, because for someone to stand up and say something that you never expect, that has all that wisdom and passion, compassion for his race, compassion for the human race is what I'm saying. And I think the interesting thing about Rodney was he was a whiner. He struck me as somebody that, he said, Larry, when I realized that there was a video of what those cops did to me, it was like the first time in my life something broke my way. He said, finally, I got a break. Finally, I caught a break. But the defense was smart. You know what they did? They ran that tape so many times, over and over and over again in the courtroom, that the impact of it was blunted. And after a while, I think the jurists were just sick of looking at it. And I think that worked against Rodney when
it came to
the verdict.
But you don't think it was a racial thing? We've had a lot of the attorneys from the O.J. Simpson case on our show, especially last year when it was the 20th anniversary. And the racial question came up every time. We're there in Simi Valley, and that may be true, but at the same time, there wasn't a whole lot of sympathy, perhaps, for a black man.
Yeah, well, they say the pendulum swings. A lot of people say O.J. got off because Rodney got nailed. You know, it's really odd the way the public consciousness and the public sympathies swing back and forth. And you say, okay, it's time for somebody to catch a break again. Rodney couldn't believe it, and he really wanted to take the stand. That was the one thing that Harper won was great. They're based in San Francisco. Harper Collins had done my first book, and then Harper won stepped up in a big way and said, we really need to tell Rodney's story, and it's a redemptive story. And that was the one thing that he really, he was bitter about that till his final days, was that they never let him take the stand and tell people what it was like being beaten up by four policemen.
Terry, do you think that's necessary? Was it necessary to hear what it was like being beaten up when we could watch the video?
Yes, I think that was a wrong move on their part. I think he should have testified. Well, look at the outcome of it. Look at what happened. Nobody, they were acquitted, and that's what started the riots. So maybe if this man actually got to say his piece and talk about how he felt, it may have moved the jurors.
But it's not a question of how he felt. What people don't understand from the legal perspective for lawyers is that you could put Rodney King up and they on the stand, and they could rip him apart for alcoholism, for what he did, resisting arrest. And he later said, you know, that was the wrong move. Obviously, he didn't feel he should have gotten beaten silly because of
but
that.
But if he would have said that, Alan, I did the wrong thing. But I don't deserve to be beaten and broken
him.
Up. But if even if you, let's say you were, you know, part of the, you know, opposing counsel, and he's like, you resisted arrest. You did this. You did this. And he goes, and he sat there and said and took responsibility for it all and said, that was wrong, but I didn't deserve to be beaten. I'm telling you, it can sway the jurors that way, especially when people take responsibility.
Larry, that point must have come out. When you talk to Rodney about it, don't you feel that it was really about race, not about the facts of the case?
Yeah, he thought it was pretty much cut and dry that way. And one can't blame him for feeling that way. He had, and believe me, I believe in spirituality. I believe that there's more out there than greets our five senses every day. But he had what he called an out-of-body experience where he floated above himself just before he thought he was going to die. Because at that point, he had already had a broken ankle from one of the hammer blows of the clubs. And he was spitting up and blood was flowing into his neck. And he said, for some damn reason, I had to get back into my body and I had to live through this. And he remembers the first thing he did when he felt himself re-enter his chest cavity was turn so that he could spit out all this blood.
Ugh.
And and if you look at the video, you can see that moment. And that's what I think allowed him to live and then go through his own hell with the police.
Did he have disdain for the cops? Did he ever say anything about each individual police officer who was acquitted? Later, of course, the federal trial, two of them ended up being convicted for a violation of human rights.
Yeah.
But that was a year later. And then, of course, in the civil trial, he recovered from the city, I think it was $3.8 million.
That's correct. Which
apparently he didn't see a lot of the fruits of.
He saw about half of that, and then he had this dream to start a rap company. Mm. And so he blew through half of that in no time, and then he
but he was awarded he was awarded attorney fees as well, $1.7 million. So why was half of the other one gone?
I think he never saw those checks. I think that the attorneys held them for one reason or another. And he was very poorly coached. He never really had a manager. He never really had someone to help him with his finances. And that shouldn't surprise anyone because he was suspicious of any middleman, of anyone that had any financial acumen that said, look, Rodney, you really need somebody like me to control this flow.
But and isn't it true with the Altapaz, I think that was what his label was called, the hip-hop label, mm-hmm. that he did the same thing with his business. He didn't really get professionals in there. He had all his friends trying to make this label, and the performers weren't, you know, up and coming, and he just blew all the money basically on friends when he didn't have the business acumen or he didn't get the people to help him out.
I know. And it's a freshman mistake. I mean anyone that tries to be a rock star, you know, always has to take a few good lumps of reality before they can figure out the actual way to do it. So I don't blame them so much for that. I do think it was sad because they did set up a trust, and the trust was something that would allow him a modest income for the rest of his life. And he immediately wanted access to that as soon as he blew through the funds that he was allowed.
That's
and
too bad.
That was his...
When you knew him, when you were writing the book with him, how was his demeanor? Was he at peace? Did he have money? You know, I know he has children and grandchildren. Did they get some of the funds from the lawsuit?
No, that's all was dried up before he had a grandchild, and definitely before he had his third daughter. I think the sad thing about it is that it was always him looking back and feeling as though, again, he had gotten the short end of the stick. You know, but there was a side of him that took responsibility. We would sit down in just a diner booth, and he would shift. He couldn't sit in one position for more than 30 seconds, a minute, because his skull, you know, his skull fractures and the hairline fractures in his body had healed, but he was always like pre-arthritic, you know, for a 44-year-old man.
Wow. It's crazy when you think about it, and what this conjures up, you know, now it's the 25th anniversary. You lived it with Rodney King. He's gone. And I looked on your Facebook page, and I know you had, at the time that he passed away, it was very painful for you. So you obviously forged a really nice, special relationship with him. How do you feel now with the 25th anniversary of the Rodney King acquittal, the Simi Valley jury's acquittal, and then the subsequent riots? How does it make you feel as Larry Spagnola?
Thank you. That's a great question. I mean, I could be the predictable pessimist here and say that we've learned nothing, that we still have street riots, that we still have situations where young men are waving a cell phone and get shot because the officer thinks it's a gun, that we're just doomed to make the same mistakes over and over again. But I see in the millennials a desire to try and be pacifist, to be less aggressive, to try and have a society where we don't have pockets of neighborhoods where if you go in, it's crime ridden. And I think it's, you know, I'm placing my hope in that generation that there's going to be a day where we can all live together and, you know, fulfill Rodney's hope that we can all get along.
There you go.
What do you think when people say, well, he was just a criminal? You know, why are we looking up to Rodney King? Why is everybody, well, Rodney King and this and that, and why was he put on this pedestal, but he was a criminal? What do you say to people that say that?
Carrie, that's a great question, because he knew that he had a dark side, and he would slide on it. Sometimes he loved the fact that a cop would stop, and this happened at least a half a dozen times, where a patrolman would stop him for speeding or driving erratically, see it was Rodney King, and say, okay, this didn't happen. Just get going. I don't even want to know.
Wow.
And because it was just too much to get involved with him. So there was this side of him that kind of, in a mischievous way, enjoyed that. And then there was another side of him that wished that he had learned a lesson. I can't imagine what happens to you when you do angel dust for like 8-10 years in a row, how that must scramble your brain pan. And I can't imagine what it's like to you know, be someone who was always drinking heavily,
Larry,
to get
you
rid
know,
of pain.
Actually, if anyone can imagine, you probably can, because your other focus that we want to talk about just for a few moments here is Steven Adler. I mean, when you talk about a brain being scrambled, you had Rodney King and Steven Adler as your subjects. And for those of you who don't know, Steven Adler was the original drummer for Guns N' Roses, and the book is called My Appetite for Destruction, Sex and Drugs and Guns N' Roses. And just this year, Steven's mother, Deanna Adler, has written a book called Sweet Child of Mine with Larry Spagnola, and you're just in the middle of all of this mess.
I've been very fortunate to have met Stephen's mother, and we have a 10-year relationship now. She, I think, tells the definitive story. And actually, Slash and Axel were laughing about this, said, Deanna knows the story because she was sober. She was the only one that was sober at the time, man. We don't remember opening for the Stones. We don't remember our first big break. We were all junkies, you know, that, and that was the hypocrisy of it, too, is when they kicked Steven out of the band, they were all opioid addicts.
Anybody
at that point
who knew Guns N' Roses knew that. If you knew the band, you knew that. Everybody was doing drugs. That's, I mean, I was such a massive follower. I was 12 or 13 at the time, and I would hitchhike to the Sunset Strip. And I would, I mean, this is how crazy rock and roll I was. And I'd try and get into the Troubadour, and I'd try and get into, like, Gazzari's. And I mean, I was so crazy. I loved Guns N' Roses so much, but you knew that they were on drugs. Yeah. You knew that.
Well,
so when Axel, at a concert I was at, was like, talking about Steven Adler up on stage and what a junkie he was, I'm going, what a hypocrite.
Yeah. I love what Fran Drescher said about the book. She said, there's no glamour in substance abuse, only self-destruction. Like, this whole glamour thing is to how much you can, you know, ingest, how much drugs you can do before you go out and perform. I mean, and everyone's been through it. You know, Kendricks, Clapton, Townsend, but all the way up to today. And these guys, the young guys, are learning just to stay away from this
stuff. If you want to learn about it, you got to pick up Larry's books. First of all, The Riot Within, My Journey from Rebellion to Redemption with Rodney King. How can people get that book if they haven't read it already?
Yeah, that should be back on Amazon. And if not, it's in some brick-and-mortar stores, especially Barnes & Noble. If you just go to them, they have it. And if it's not on their shelf, they can get it to you within the week.
And My Appetite for Destruction, Sex and Drugs and Guns N' Roses, and the new book by Deanna Adler and Larry Spagnola, Sweet Child of Mine. That's available.
Yes, it is. It's Barnes & Noble, Amazon, anywhere you want to get it. Right now it's enjoying. And the first book is enjoying a renaissance because of Deanna's book, Sweet Child of Mine. And I have to tell both, Carrie had mentioned what a great record My Appetite for Destruction is. And Appetite for Destruction has the distinction of being the highest-selling debut album of any rock and roll band of all time.
Wow.
Yeah. Which is amazing. Beatles, Stones, you know, Van Halen, Metallica, it doesn't matter. Theirs is the first and greatest.
Wow. Yes. Well, we have to take a quick break. Larry Spagnola, thanks so much for being on Gurry's Law. Fascinating stuff as we commemorate the 25th year of the L.A. riots. After the break, we're going to have Jonathan Chin on. Jonathan Chin is a producer with Lightbox, and they have a film coming out, a documentary on the riots called L.A. 92. You don't want to miss that. You're listening to Gurry's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Have you or someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RGW Lawyers won't give up when the insurance company fails you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposure, cancers, and death. RGW Lawyers are compassionate and aggressive with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner if you're suffering from a work-related injury. Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now. 855-4-RGW-LAW. 855-4-RGW-LAW or go to rgwlawfirm.com.
Hi. This is Chip Wade, DIY expert, TV host, and lead designer for Wade Works Creative. The great outdoors just got greater. You can spruce up your spring with all the lawn and gardening supplies you'll need from the Home Depot. They also have guaranteed low prices on outdoor power equipment from top brands like Ryobi, Toro, Ego, and Echo. Plus, they have all the newest grills and patio sets to keep your outdoors trendy all season long. Visit homedepot.com/gardeningcenter for details. The Home Depot. More saving, more doing.
It's Spring Black Friday at the Home Depot, where right now, select John Deere mowers come with a free Home Depot gift card worth up to $350. From zero-turn models to the new Excel cutting decks, John Deere gives you a quality cut that won't cut into your downtime. And that free Home Depot gift card puts even more spring in your pocket. Buy a John Deere, get a gift card during Spring Black Friday only at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Valid through April 19th in store and online. Gift card via mail-in rebate. See store for details.
Hey, Metro PCS and Cricket customers. Are you tired of family plans with data limits? Check out Boost Mobile's best family plan ever. Right now, add a line with unlimited gigs for just $30 a month. Is that an amazing value or what? Even more amazing, you can add up to four lines with unlimited gigs for $30 each, all on Boost's crazy fast nationwide network. And did we mention that your first month is free for your new lines? Plus, when you switch, you can get up to four free Samsung Galaxy phones. Goodbye, Metro PCS. See ya, Cricket. Hello, Boost, and the best family plan ever. What are you waiting for? Visit a Boost Mobile store today. Offer ends 6/1/17. Primary line must be on $50 plan. Video streams optimized at 480p plus. Music up to 500 kilobits per second. And cloud gaming up to 2 megabits per second. Data deprioritization applies during congestion. 3 month credit for each additional line is $30. Max 4 additional lines. Credit applied at time of activation. Free phone requires port in and activation on $50 plan while supplies last. Coverage and offers not available everywhere. Restrictions apply.
Hey, this is Dr. Drew.
And I'm Mike Catherwood.
And on the next Midday Live, Mike, I got some good news for you.
What is it, Drew?
This research has shown that 1 in 4 individuals don't think that a one-night stand counts as cheating.
Well, as long as your wife is one of those 25%, you and I can bang it out all we want.
All right, Midday Live, Dr. Drew, Mike Catherwood, Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Wake up with Doug McIntyre in the morning.
L.A. mailmen get bitten by dogs more than any other city in the country. A National Dog Bite Prevention Week does a survey and ranks L.A. as the top list of 30 cities ranked. There were 80 mail carriers attacked last year. That's the bad news. The good news is that L.A. has the most delicious mailmen.
McIntyre in the morning. Now with Leanne Tweeden News. 5 to 10 on KABC.
You've heard of Murphy's Law, but have you heard of Gervie's Law? Anything that can go wrong can be made right. Now, here are your hosts, Kerry Kasem and Alan Gervie.
Yes, we are back. I'm Alan Gervie. I'm here with Kerry Kasem, and let's start a riot. Mm-hmm. Let's not start a riot. We're talking about the L.A. riots. It's the 25th anniversary, and we're happy to have with us right now Jonathan Chin. Jonathan Chin is an Emmy Award-winning television producer who has a documentary coming out shortly. L.A. 92 will be premiering at the Tribeca Film Festival, and we'll be on the National Geographic station at the end of the month. Jonathan, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Pleasure to be there. Thanks for having me.
It's great having you, and I know you don't have a whole lot of time, so we got a lot of stuff to get through. Tell us about the film, and primarily I want to know the statement, let the film footage speak for itself. What does that mean to you and LA 92?
Well, you know, when we undertook this project over a year ago, obviously we were very aware of the sensitivities about this issue, and I think we kind of collectively felt that it would be interesting and responsible to tell the film using just archive footage, no interviews, no commentary, no analysis, just to immerse the viewer in the, you know, from the Rodney King beating all the way through to the conclusion of the riots, just to immerse the viewer through raw footage all kinds of different kinds of archive footage and sort of leave the analysis out of it so that the viewer can kind of make up their own mind about the causes, the culpability, and the people involved.
How do you and your cousin Simon Chin get interested in the LA riots and putting this documentary together?
Well, you know, we realized it was the 25th anniversary of the civil unrest in Los Angeles about 18 months ago. And I was actually in Los Angeles during the riots. I was at USC Film School. I was right there in South Central. So for me personally, I had a kind of emotional connection to it. I lived through it. Obviously, I was coming at it from a fairly privileged point of view, being at a private university, and I was certainly not living through it the way that a lot of Los Angelinos were living through it. But for me, it's as a Los Angelino, as somebody, that was my first year in Los Angeles. I arrived here in January of '92, so it was a real awakening as to some of the issues that the city that I'd chosen to be home were facing at the time.
Right.
And so for me, that was a big part of wanting to do this project.
Did you ever think about leaving, saying that America, this is crazy, I'm out of here?
No, because I moved here from New York, which has its own issues, not just racial tensions, but all kinds of issues with corrupt police force and all this kind of stuff. I didn't think about leaving. It was just a wake up call in terms of the fact that these things, however much you want to sort of, kind of turn a blind eye to it and get in your car and drive on the freeway and kind of forget about the bigger story of Los Angeles, we all have to, Los Angelinos, but also as Americans, we have to face up to what is clearly the Achilles heel of our country, which is these racial tensions that are deeply rooted and the injustices that are borne out because of those things on all sides. And again, the choice not to interview people and not to use a voiceover or commentary and just let the events sort of play out was partly made because we don't want to apportion blame as filmmakers. We're much more interested in sort of presenting what happened and allowing the audience and the viewers to sort of decide amongst themselves. And also, we also wanted to start a conversation with the film.
Jonathan,
the short answer is yeah, go ahead.
I was going to ask you, because it's very fascinating, and the footage is fascinating. How did you know that you would be able to find this rarely seen footage? Because I know from L.A. First, AME Church, L.A. Police and Fire Department, news broadcasts from a Korean TV station. How did you find this stuff to make it so fascinating?
How do we know we would find it? I think we did a little bit of sort of cursory research before we sold it to National Geographic. And I think our sense was, and one can never be sure, but our sense was that there was stuff out there. Don't forget that one of the catalysts of the Los Angeles riots was the videotaping of the beating of Rodney King, which was done on a consumer camera by just an average citizen. I mean, in some ways, it's been one of the earliest examples of citizen journalism, if you like. So consumer cameras were making their way into the population. It was also in Los Angeles, which is, obviously lots of cameras in Los Angeles, lots of people interested in film and filming and documentaries. I myself was at film school. So I think we thought we would, if we dug deep enough, we would have some luck in terms of, citizen journalism, for lack of a better word. And then the other part of accumulating archive at this level, and we needed thousands of hours, in order to kind of cull it all down into the, little less than 2 hours that we have. I mean, to be honest, it's about resources, and we were lucky enough that I think National Geographic, once they had sort of bitten on the hook of what our vision was for the film to do this all archive, I think they realized that would take some resources. So, we were able to bring on a sort of 4 or 5 person team who spent months going down every avenue. And, a lot of it was detective work. A lot of it was seeing some archive and then sort of seeing a camera person in that archive and trying to figure out who that person might be to get that angle. And it was a lot of detective work. But, I think hopefully our hunch proved to be right. But it does take resources. You can't do it on a shoestring budget.
How many hours of footage do you say you had, those 5 people had to look through?
Probably about 2,000 altogether, and then a whole host of audio recordings in addition, police scanners, as you mentioned, Korean radio, local radio, and we really left very few stones unturned in our, you know, desire to try and A, find stuff that people hadn't seen or heard before, but also try and represent the sort of swath of communities within Los Angeles during that period. But yeah, I would say a couple thousand hours that, you know, not just the researchers and archivists, but also the directors themselves, Daniel Lindsay and T.J. Martin, watched most of it. I mean, they needed to know kind of what was out there, and since they essentially edited the film themselves, they had a really good grasp of certainly hundreds, if not a thousand or so of those.
Jonathan,
hours.
You would be remiss if you didn't talk about the orchestral score composed by Danny Bensey and Sondre Juryens, because that really makes the film, don't you think?
Absolutely. I would absolutely be remiss if I didn't talk about that aspect of the film, which I think also we knew from, you know, quite early on that it was going to be instrumental, because no pun intended, because the film has no narration as such, no spoken word narration. And I think part of what Dan and TJ wanted to do was allow the score by, as you mentioned, Danny and Sondre, who are just, you know, brilliant composers, have composed for a number of feature films and you know, premium television shows. So you know, the kind of pitch to them was, we were trying to make the LA riots, the telling of the LA riots, a little bit symphonic,
right?
And
I would say visceral as well. There's really, you know, the feeling when you watch the film, and what's impressive is that you have a deal with Picture Motion for free screenings to colleges and universities with the discussion
That's right.
guide. That's really important. Why don't you talk about that for a moment?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I think, again, going back to this notion of how do we make this film responsibly, and instead of just sort of, you know, cashing in on the anniversary, actually try and become part of the conversation to look back at that and the situation, the country that we live in now. So I think always part of the plan was a way to have this film be a conversation starter. And I think what better place to do that than in the university setting and in an academic setting with kids who are learning about history, learning about these issues. And hopefully a film like this can spark conversation on a higher level, you know, amongst tomorrow's leaders, you know. That was the thought behind that. And obviously, I know the film's going to go out for free on a few platforms. And again, that's hats off to Nat Geo for sort of, you know, kind of putting, I think, a little bit of education ahead
sure.
of entertainment and money making, is that I think they're prepared to, you know, once it's aired in Nat Geo, to sort of allow other people an opportunity who don't pay for Nat Geo, don't have access to it, to get it through all kinds of online platforms. So that's exciting for us.
What about high schools? And here's my feeling with the high schools. It's because, you know, I think a lot of the people that rioted, and I could be completely wrong, probably weren't in college and probably weren't, you know, didn't have a higher, you know, education, a learning like a college mm-hmm. degree. So you're looking at, like, you know, sticking this in high schools, you know, so, you know, whether the kid goes on to college or doesn't get out, they can see it. They see what happened. They get that history of it, because I think you're missing a whole bunch of, you know, a demographic that may not see it.
Maybe you
may
should
not look at it. May not look at a documentary.
You need a marketer.
No, I'm just saying. I think that would be so great for, you know,
yeah,
kids like that.
I totally agree. I mean, and you know, I'm going to look into it because I agree. I know that we are desperately trying to get a younger audience for this film through all kinds of platforms. And let's be honest, I don't think a ton of high school kids, certainly from the inner cities, watch National Geographic go to the Tribeca Film Festival. So, you know, how can we get this film? I think you're absolutely right. How can we get this film to people, to kids, really, who didn't live through it, who might feel disconnected to it, but maybe connected to other struggles and plights that they are living through, you know, not to mention the current political climate, which just, you know, feels so divisive and in some ways, you know, sometimes so hopeless. So I'm definitely going to follow up on that. That's a really great suggestion. Yeah. Thank you for that.
You know, I know you got a good education at USC. I don't know if you knew my friend Ken Koken there. He was there at the time, and Brian Singer. They were doing a show.
Yes, I remember Brian. He ended up doing okay for himself.
Yeah, he did okay. They did a movie called Public Access when you were at USC.
That's right.
And then Usual Suspects after that. So, you know, Ken and Brian, it's a great training ground. And obviously, you have done extremely well. You have another documentary in development, Whitney Houston. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, we're actually in production, and it's, you know, I would put it on the other side of the scale certainly from LA 92. I mean, you know, we were approached by the Whitney Houston estate, I think hopefully because of our credibility and our track record, and they were looking for some producers to bring to screen sort of the first and only authorized documentary about Whitney Houston. There hasn't been one ever, and certainly since, you know, hasn't even been really discussed much since her passing. And so the estate came to us, and we were lucky enough to attach Kevin McDonald to direct the film. He previously directed Touching the Void,
right.
King of Scotland, One Day in September. He's a Academy Award winner and just a phenomenal director. So yeah, I mean, I would say that's much more of a commercial venture than something like LA 92. But we're excited
right.
about it.
We're looking forward to seeing it. A lot of us are Whitney Houston fans, and of course, want to know a lot more. And that's what these films do. Tell us before we let you go, LA 92. How can people see it? Because it's really important that they do.
Well, the best way to see it, the easiest way to see it, is to tune into National Geographic on April 30th. I believe it's 9 p.m. On the 30th on Sunday. That's the best way and easiest way. Obviously, it will be in theaters for a limited theatrical run immediately following its Tribeca premiere. So I think it hits theaters in New York and L.A. I want to say the 27th, 28th. There are several word-of-mouth screenings across the country we're doing in areas that we think the film might resonate: Baltimore, St. Louis, Chicago, New York, Los Angeles. But the best way to see it is to either tune in to Nat Geo on Sunday night on April 30th, or look out for those free screenings that I mentioned that will be on all kinds of online platforms. So you can definitely log into Nat Geo and type in LA 92, and it'll tell you how to see the film.
It definitely is an important film. It's an important event, 25th anniversary of the LA riots. And Jonathan Chin, we want to thank you for being on Gervie's Law, and we'll look for more of your work from Lightbox Productions, and hopefully the Whitney Houston, maybe we can talk to you about that when that finally comes out.
We would love to talk to you about it. I want to thank you guys for including me on your program and for taking an interest in not just the film, but also what the film is about. You know, where, as Rodney King said, we're all in this together. Let's figure out a way.
That's right.
Yep.
And we had, just before you were on, we had Larry Spagnola on, who wrote the book with Rodney King. And that was something
fantastic.
That it was really important for Larry to talk about, that Rodney felt very, it was something for him to try to bring people together, even in this racial divide, which is something that's true enough today.
And he said that quote would live on more than the quotes from Bush, read my lips, more than, you know, I didn't have sex with that woman, Clinton. And then you come out at the end of the show and you say that. And he said,
right.
You know, Rodney may not be remembered, but that quote always will.
That's right.
Oh, for sure. Well, thank you
all
for
right,
having
thanks.
Me on.
Take
and
care.
We'll catch you on the next one.
Sounds good. Thanks, Jonathan.
Okay.
Bye.
Wow. Bye-bye. Wow, that really kind of puts a ribbon around. We started in a place having David Dow pulled and yanked off the airplane, and we finished up with, can't we just all get along?
Isn't that amazing? I mean, we literally talked about that just, 20 minutes ago.
Yeah. And it's true. I mean, I really believe that. But it's so hard. As a lawyer, I'm litigating all day long. I'm in adversarial proceedings all day long. And I really wish I could just be Rodney King and say, can't we all just get along? But apparently we can't. That's my positive message
Some
of the
of us
day.
Can. Some of us
Who
can.
Who do you get along with besides Jesse?
I mean, pretty much everybody. You know, it's the people that are not nice. I don't like not nice people, and I don't like people who steal and who isolate people from family members. Those are the people I would fight against to my last breath.
So
everybody
I guess,
else?
You know, as far as the racial thing goes, yeah, let's try and focus on getting along. I know it's not easy. We want to thank everyone who was listening today to Gervie's Law. We're hearing little Guns N' Roses as we say adieu. Thanks, John. Thanks, Dino. Thanks, Debbie. Thank you all for putting together this great show, and we will see you next week.
Bye.
This show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn.
News. Talk. Evolve. KABC. Los Angeles. Orange County. A Cumulus station.
Protests and counter-protests. Pence visit.